Audible Frontiers presents The Darkness That Comes Before, written by R. Scott Baker, narrated by David DeVries.
I shall never tire of underlining a concise little fact which these superstitious people are loath to admit, namely, that a thought comes when it wants, not when I want. Friedrich Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil. Prologue. The Wastes of Kunayuri. If it is only after that we understand what has come before, then we understand nothing. Thus we shall define the soul as follows: that which precedes everything. Agensis, the third analytic of men. 2147, Year of the Tusk. The Mountains of Demua. One cannot raise walls against what has been forgotten. The citadel of Ishual succumbed during the height of the apocalypse, but no army of inhuman Srunk had scaled its ramparts. No furnace-hearted dragon had pulled down its mighty gates. Ishual was the secret refuge of the Kunayuric High Kings, and no one, not even the No-God, could besiege a secret. Months earlier, Anasarimbor Ganrelka II, High King of Kunayuri, had fled to Ishual with the remnants of his household. From the walls, his sentries stared pensively across the dark forests below, their thoughts stricken by memories of burning cities and wailing multitudes. When the wind moaned, they gripped Ishual's uncaring stone, reminded of Srunk horns. They traded breathless reassurances. Had they not eluded their pursuers? Were not the walls of Ishual strong? Where else might a man survive the end of the world? The plague claimed the High King first, as was perhaps fitting. Ganrelka had only wept at Ishual, raged the way only an emperor of nothing could rage. The following night, the members of his household carried his bier down into the forests. They glimpsed the eyes of wolves reflected in the light of his pyre. They sang no dirges, intoned only a few numb prayers. Before the morning winds could sweep his ashes skyward, the plague had struck two others, Ganrelka's concubine and her daughter. As though pursuing his bloodline to its thinnest tincture, it assailed more and more members of his household. The sentries upon the walls became fewer, and though they still watched the mountainous horizon, they saw little. The cries of the dying crowded their thoughts with too much horror. Soon even the sentries were no more. The five knights of Trice, who'd rescued Ganrelka after the catastrophe on the fields of Eleniot, lay motionless in their beds. The Grand Vizier, his golden robe stained bloody by his bowel, lay sprawled across his sorcerous texts. Ganrelka's uncle, who'd led the heartbreaking assault on Golgotharoth's gates in the early days of the apocalypse, hung from a rope in his chambers, slowly twisting in a draft. The queen stared endlessly across festering sheets. Of all those who had fled to Ishual, only Ganrelka's bastard son and the bardic priest survived. Terrified by the bard's strange manner and one white eye, the young boy hid, venturing out only when his hunger became unbearable. The old bard continually searched for him, singing ancient songs of love and battle, but slurring the words in blasphemous ways.
"Why won't you show yourself, child?" he would cry as he reeled through the galleries. "Let me sing to you, woo you with secret songs, let me share the glory of what once was."
One night, the bard caught the boy. He caressed first his cheek and then his thigh.
"Forgive me,"
he muttered over and over, but tears fell only from his blind eye.
"There are no crimes,"
he mumbled afterward,
"when no one is left alive."
But the boy lived. Five nights later, he lured the bardic priest onto Ishual's towering walls. When the man shambled by in a drunken stupor, he pushed him from the heights. He crouched for a long while at the fall's edge, staring down through the gloom at the bard's broken corpse. It differed from the others, he decided, only in that it was still wet. Was it murder when no one was left alive? Winter added its cold to the emptiness of Ishual. Propped on the battlements, the child would listen to the wolves sing and feud through the dark forests. He would pull his arms from his sleeves and hug his body against the chill, murmuring his dead mother's songs and savoring the wind's bite on his cheek. He would fly through the courtyards, answering the wolves with Kunayoric war cries, brandishing weapons that staggered him with their weight. And once in a while, his eyes wide with hope and superstitious dread, he would poke the dead with his father's sword. When the snows broke, shouts brought him to Ishual's forward gate. Peering through dark embrasures, he saw a group of cadaverous men and women, refugees of the apocalypse. Glimpsing his shadow, they cried out for food, shelter, anything. But the boy was too terrified to reply. Hardship had made them look fearsome, feral, like a wolf people. When they began scaling the walls, he fled to the galleries. Like the bardic priest, they searched for him, calling out guarantees of his safety. Eventually, one of them found him cringing behind a barrel of sardines. With a voice neither tender nor harsh, he said,
"We are Dunyane, child. What reason could you have to fear us?"
But the boy clutched his father's sword, crying, "So long as men live, there are crimes." The man's eyes filled with wonder.
"No, child," he said, "only so long as men are deceived."
For a moment, the young Anasarimber could only stare at him. Then solemnly, he set aside his father's sword and took the stranger's hand. "I was a prince," he mumbled. The stranger brought him to the others, and together they celebrated their strange fortune. They cried out, not to the gods they had repudiated, but to one another, that here was evident a great correspondence of cause. Here, awareness most holy could be tended. In Ishual, they had found shelter against the end of the world. Still emaciated, but wearing the furs of kings, the Dunyane chiseled the sorcerous runes from the walls and burned the Grand Vizier's books. The jewels, the chalcedony, the silk and cloth of gold, they buried with the corpses of a dynasty, and the world forgot them for 2,000 years. Nonmen, Srank, and men, the first forgets, the third regrets, and the second has all of the fun. Ancient Kunayuri Nursery Rhyme. This is a history of a great and tragic holy war, of the mighty factions that sought to possess and pervert it, and of a son searching for his father. And as with all histories, it is we, the survivors, who will write its conclusion. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Late Autumn, 4109, Year of the Tusk, the Mountains of Demua. Again, the dreams had come. Vast landscapes, histories, contests of faith and culture, all glimpsed in cataracts of detail. Horses skidding to earth, fists clenching mud, dead strewn on the shore of a warm sea, and as always, an ancient city, chalk dry in the sun, rising against dun hills. A holy city, Shima. And then the voice, thin as though spoken through the reed throat of a serpent, saying,
"Send to me, my son."
The dreamers awoke as one, gasping, struggling to wrest sense from impossibility. Following the protocol established after the first dreams, they found each other in the unlit depths of the thousand, thousand halls. Such desecration, they determined, could no longer be tolerated. Climbing pitted mountain trails, Anasarimber Kellis leaned on his knee and turned to look at the monastic citadel. Ishual's ramparts towered above a screen of spruce and larches, only to be dwarfed by the rutted mountain slopes beyond.
"Did you see it thus, father?" Did you turn and look for one last time?
Distant figures filed between the battlements before disappearing behind stone, the elder Dunyane abandoning their vigil. They would wind down the mighty staircases, Kellis knew, and one by one enter the darkness of the thousand halls, the great labyrinth that wheeled through the depths beneath Ishual. There they would die, as had been decided, all those his father had polluted.
I'm alone. My mission is all that remains.
He turned from Ishual and continued climbing through the forest. The mountain breeze was bitter with the smell of bruised pine. By late afternoon, he passed the timberline, and after 2 days of scaling glacial slopes, he crested the roof of the Demua Mountains. On the far side of the range, the forests of what once had been called Kunayuri extended beneath scudding clouds. How many vistas such as this, he wondered, must he cross before he found his father? How many ravine-creased horizons must he exchange before he arrived at Shima?
Shima will be my home. I shall dwell in my father's house.
Descending granite escarpments, he entered the wilderness. He wandered through the gloom of the forest interior, through galleries pillared by mighty redwoods and hushed by the overlong absence of men. He tugged his cloak through thickets and negotiated the fierce rush of mountain streams. Though the forests below Ishual had been much the same, Kellis found himself unsettled for some reason. He paused in an attempt to regain his composure, using ancient techniques to impose discipline on his intellect. The forest was quiet, gentle with birdsong, and yet he could hear thunder.
Something is happening to me. Is this the first trial, Father?
He found a stream marbled by brilliant sunlight and knelt at its edge. The water he drew to his lips was more replenishing, more sweet than any water he had tasted before. But how could water taste sweet? How could sunlight, broken across the back of rushing waters, be so beautiful? What comes before determines what comes after. Dunyane monks spent their lives immersed in the study of this principle, illuminating the intangible mesh of cause and effect that determined every happenstance and minimizing all that was wild and unpredictable. Because of this, events always unfolded with granitic certainty in Ishual. More often than not, one knew the skittering course a leaf would take through the terrace groves. More often than not, one knew what another would say before he spoke. To grasp what came before was to know what would come after, and to know what would come after was the beauty that stilled the hallow communion of intellect and circumstance, the gift of the Logos. Kellis's first true surprise, apart from the formative days of his childhood, had been this mission. Until then, his life had been a premeditated ritual of study, conditioning, and comprehension. Everything was grasped, everything was understood. But now, walking through the forests of lost Kunayuri, it seemed that the world plunged and he stood still. Like earth in rushing waters, he was battered by an endless succession of surprises. The thin warble of an unknown bird, burrs in his cloak from an unknown weed, a snake winding through a sunlit clearing, searching for unknown prey. The dry slap of wings would pass overhead and he would pause, taking a different step. A mosquito would land on his cheek and he would slap at it, only to have his eyes drawn to a different configuration of tree. His surroundings inhabited him, possessed him, until he was moved by all things at once. The creak of limbs, the endless permutations of water over stones, these things racked him with the strength of tides. On the afternoon of the 17th day, a twig lodged itself between his sandal and his foot. He held it against storm-piled clouds and studied it, became lost in its shape, in the path it traveled through the open air, the thin, muscular branchings that seized so much emptiness from the sky. Had it simply fallen into this shape? Or had it been cast, a mold drained of its wax? He looked up and saw one sky plied by the infinite forking of branches. Was there not one way to grasp one sky? He was unaware of how long he stood there, but it was dark before the twig slipped from his fingers. On the morning of the 29th day, he crouched on rocks green with moss and watched salmon leap and pitch against a rushing river. The sun rose and set three times before his thoughts escaped this inexplicable war of fish and waters. In the worst moments, his arms would be vague as shadow against shadow, and the rhythm of his walk would climb far ahead of him. His mission became the last remnant of what he had once been. Otherwise, he was devoid of intellect, oblivious to the principles of the Dunyain. Like a sheet of parchment exposed to the elements, each day saw more words stolen from him, until only one imperative remained. Shima. I must find my father in Shima. He continued wandering south, through the foothills of the Dumua. His dispossession deepened until he no longer oiled his sword after being wetted by the rain, until he no longer slept or ate. There was only wilderness, the walk, and the passing days. At night, he would take animal comfort in the dark and cold. Shima, please, father. On the 43rd day, he waded across a shallow river and clambered onto banks black with ash. Weeds crowded the char, blanketing the ground, but nothing else. Like blackened spears, dead trees spiked the sky. He picked his way through the debris, stung by weeds where they brushed his bare skin. Finally, he gained the summit of a ridge. The immensity of the valley below struck Kellis breathless. Beyond the fire's desolation, where the forest was still dark and crowded, ancient fortifications loomed above the trees, forming a great ring across the autumnal distances. He watched birds wheel over and around the nearer ramparts, flash across stretches of mottled stone, before dipping into the canopy. Ruined walls, so cold and so forlorn, in a way the forest could never be. The ruins were far too old to contradict the forest outright. They had been submerged, worn and unbalanced by ages of its weight, sheltered in mossy hollows, walls breached earthen mounds, only to suddenly end, as though restrained by vines that wrapped them like great vines over bone. But there was something in them, something not now, that bent Kellis toward unfamiliar passions. When he brushed his hands across the stone, he knew he touched the breath and toil of men, the mark of a destroyed people. The ground wheeled. He leaned forward and pressed his cheek against the stone. Grit and the cold of uncovered earth. Above, the sunlight was broken by a span of knotted branches. Men, here in the stone, old and untouched by the rigor of the Dunyain. Somehow they had resisted the sleep, had raised the work of hands against the wilderness. Who built this place? Kellis wandered over the mounds, sensing the ruins buried beneath. He ate sparingly from his forgotten satchel, dried wafers and acorns. He peeled leaves from the surface of a small pool of rainwater, drank, then stared curiously at the dark reflection of his own face, at the growth of blonde hair across his scalp and jaw. Is this me? He studied squirrels and those birds he could pick from the dim confusion of the trees. Once he glimpsed a fox slipping through the brush. I am not one more animal. His intellect flailed, found purchase, and grasped. He could sense wild caws sweep around him in statistical tides, touch him, and leave him untouched. I am a man. I stand apart from these things. As evening waxed, it began to rain. Through branches he watched the clouds build, chill and gray. For the first time in weeks, he sought shelter. He picked his way into a small gully where erosion had caused a sheaf of earth to fall away, revealing the stone facade of some structure. He climbed over the leafy clay into an opening, dark and deep. Inside, he broke the neck of the wild dog that attacked him. He was familiar with darkness. Light had been forbidden in the depths of the labyrinth. But there was no mathematical insight in the cramped blackness he found, only a random jumble of earth-pinched walls. Anasarimber Kellis stretched out and slept. When he awoke, The forest was quiet with snow. The Dunyane had no real knowledge of just how far Shima lay. They had merely provided him with as many provisions as he could efficiently carry. His satchel grew flimsier with the days. Kellis could only passively observe as hunger and exposure racked his body. If the wilderness could not possess him, it would kill him. His food ran out, and he continued to walk. Everything, experience, analysis, became mysteriously sharp. More snow came, and cold, harsh winds. He walked until he could no longer. "The way is too narrow, Father. Shima is too far." The trapper's sled dogs yelped and nosed through the snow. He pulled them away and fastened their harness to the base of a stunted pine. Astonished, he brushed the snow away from the limbs curling beneath. His first thought was to feed the dead man to his dogs. The wolves would have him otherwise, and meat was scarce in the abandoned north. He removed his mittens and placed his fingertips against the bearded cheek. The skin was gray, and he was certain the face would be as cold as the snow that half buried it. It was not. He cried out, and his dogs responded with a chorus of howls. He cursed, then countered with a sign of Husyelt, the dark hunter. The limbs were slack when he lifted the man from the snow. His wool and hair were stiff in the wind. The world had always been strange with significance to the trapper, but now it had become terrifying. Running as the dogs pulled the sled, he fled before the wrath of the encroaching blizzard. "Lewith," the man had said, placing a hand to his naked chest. His cropped hair was silver with a hint of bronze, and far too fine to adequately frame his thick features. His eyebrows seemed perpetually arched in surprise, and his restless eyes were given to excuses, always feigning interest in trivial details to avoid his ward's watchful gaze. Only later, after learning the rudiments of Lewith's language, did Kellis discover how he'd come to be in the trapper's care. His first memories were of sweaty furs and smoldering fires. Animal pelts hung in sheaves from a low ceiling. Sacks and casks heaped the corners of a single room. The smell of smoke, grease, and rot crowded what little open space remained. As Kellis would later learn, the chaotic interior of the cabin was actually an expression, and a painstaking one at that, of the trapper's many superstitious fears. Each thing had its place, he would tell Kellis, and those things out of place portended disaster. The hearth was large enough to hug all the interior, including Kellis himself, in golden warmth. Beyond the walls, winter whistled through trackless leagues of forest, ignoring them for the most part, but periodically shaking the cabin hard enough to rock the furs on their hooks. The land was called Sobel, Lewith would tell him, the northernmost province of the ancient city of Atrathau, although it had been abandoned for generations. He preferred, he would say, to live far from the troubles of other men. Though Lewith was a sturdy man of middle years, for Kellis he was little more than a child. The fine musculature of his face was utterly untrained, bound as though by strings to his passions. Whatever moved Lewith's soul moved his expression as well, and after a short time, Kellis needed only to glance at his face to know his thoughts. The ability to anticipate his thoughts, to reenact the movements of Lewith's soul as though they were his own, would come later. In the meantime, a routine developed. At dawn, Lewith harnessed his dogs and left to check his runs. On the days he returned early, he enlisted Kellis to mend snares, prepare skins, draw up a new pot of coney stew, to earn his keep, as he put it. At night, Kellis worked, as the trapper had taught him, unstitching his own coat and leggings. Lewith would watch from across the fire, his hands living an arcane life of their own, carving, stitching, or simply straining against each other, small labors that paradoxically gifted him with patience, even grace. Kellis saw Lewith's hands at rest only when he slept or was extraordinarily drunk. Drink more than anything else, defined the trapper. Through the morning, Lewith never looked Kellis in the eye, acknowledging him only at nervous angles. A curious halfness deadened the man. as though his thought lacked the momentum to become speech. If he spoke at all, his voice was tight, constricted by an ambient dread. By afternoon, a flush would have crept into his expression. His eyes would flare with brittle sunshine. He would smile, laugh. But by dark, his manner would be bloated, a distorted parody of what it had been just hours earlier. He would bludgeon his way through conversation, would be overcome by squalls of rage and bitter humor. Kellis learned much from Lewith's drink-exaggerated passions, but the time came when he could no longer allow his study to trade in caricatures. One night, he rolled the casks of whiskey out into the forest and drained them across the frozen ground. During the suffering that followed, he carried on with the chores. They sat facing each other across the hearth, their backs against cozy heaps of animal pelts. His expression etched by firelight, Lewith talked, animated by the honest vanity of sharing his life with someone who was captive to the facts as he described them. Old pains returned in the telling.
I had no choice but to leave Atrathau,
Lewith admitted, speaking yet again of his dead wife. Kellis smiled sorrowfully. He gauged the subtle interplay of muscles beneath the man's expression. He pretends to mourn in order to secure my pity. Atrathau reminded you of her absence? This is the lie he tells himself. Lewith nodded, his eyes at once tear-filled and expectant.
Atrathau seemed a tomb after she died. One morning they called the muster for the militia to man the walls, and I remember staring off to the north. The forest seemed to beckon me somehow. The terror of my childhood had become a sanctuary. Everyone in the city, even my brothers and my compatriots in the district cohort, seemed to secretly exult in her death, in my misery. I was forced to
avenge yourself. Lewith looked down to the fire.
Flee,
he said. Why does he deceive himself in this way? No soul moves alone through the world, Lewith. Our every thought stems from the thoughts of others. Our every word is but a repetition of words spoken before. Every time we listen, we allow the movements of another soul to carry our own. He paused, cutting short his reply in order to bewilder the man. Insight struck with so much more force when it clarified confusion. This is truly why you fled to Sobel, Lewith. For an instant, Lewith's eyes slackened in horror.
But I don't understand.
Of everything I might say, he fears most the truths he already knows and yet denies. Are all world-born men this weak? But you do understand. Think, Lewith, if we're nothing more than our thoughts and passions, and if our thoughts and passions are nothing more than movements of our souls, then we are nothing more than those who move us. Who you once were, Lewith, ceased to exist the moment your wife died.
And that's why I fled,
Lewith cried, his eyes both beseeching and provoked.
I couldn't bear it. I fled to forget.
Flare in his pulse rate, hesitation in the flex of delicate muscles about his eyes. He knows this is a lie. No, Lewith, you fled to remember. You fled to conserve all the ways your wife had moved you, to shield the ache of her loss from the momentum of others. You fled to make a bulwark of your misery. Tears spilled across the trapper's sagging cheeks.
Ah, cruel words, Kellis. Why would you say such things?
To better possess you. Because you've suffered long enough. You've spent years alone by this fire, wallowing in your loss, asking your dogs over and over whether they love you. You hoard your pain because the more you suffer, the more the world becomes an outrage. You weep because weeping has become evidence. See what you've done to me, you cry. And you hold court night after night, condemning the circumstances that have condemned you by reliving your anguish. You torment yourself, Lewith, in order to hold the world accountable for your torment. Again, he'll deny me.
And what if I do? The world is an outrage, Kellis, an outrage!
Perhaps it is, Kellis replied, his tone one of pity and regret. But the world has long ceased to be the author of your anguish. How many times have you cried out these very words? And each time they've been cramped by the same desperation, the desperation of one who needs to believe something he knows to be false. Only pause, Lewith. Refuse to follow the grooves these thoughts have worn into you. Pause, and you'll see. His thoughts forced inward, Lewith hesitated, his face stunned and slack. He understands but lacks the courage to admit. Ask yourself, Kellis pressed. Why this desperation?
There's no desperation,
Lewith replied numbly. He sees the place I've opened for him, realizes the futility of all lies in my presence, even those he tells himself. Why do you continue to lie?
Because...
Through the wheeze of the fire, Kellis could hear the pounding of Lewith's heart, fevered like that of a trapped animal. Sobs shuddered through the man. He raised his hands to bury his face, but then paused. He looked up to Kellis and wept the way a child might before his mother. It hurts, his expression cried. It hurts so much. I know it hurts, Lewith. Release from anguish can be purchased only through more anguish. So much like a child.
What should I do?
The trapper wept.
Kellis, please tell me.
30 years, father. What power you must wield over men such as this. And Kellis, his bearded face warm with firelight and compassion, answered, No one's soul moves alone, Lewith. When one love dies, one must learn to love another. After a time, the hearth fire burned low, and the two of them sat silently, listening to the gathering fury of yet another storm. The wind sounded like mighty blankets flapping against the walls. Outside, the forest groaned and whistled beneath the dark belly of the blizzard.
Weeping may muddy the face,
Lewith said, broaching their silence with an old proverb,
but it does cleanse the heart.
Kellis smiled in reply, his expression one of bemused recognition. Why, the ancient Dunyain had asked, confined the passions to words when they spoke first in expression? A legion of faces lived within him, and he could slip through them with the same ease with which he crafted his words. At the heart of his jubilant smile, his compassionate laugh flexed the cold of scrutiny. But you distrust it, Kellis said. Lewith shrugged.
Why, Kellis? Why would the gods send you to me?
For Lewith, Kellis knew, the world was fraught with gods, ghosts, even demons. It was steeped in their conspiracies, crowded with omens and portents of their capricious humors. Like a second horizon, their designs encompassed the struggles of men, shrouded, cruel, and in the end, always fatal. For Lewith, discovering him beneath the snowdrifts of Sobel was no accident. You wish to know why I've come?
Why have you come?
So far, Kellis had avoided any talk of his mission, and Lewith, terrified by the speed with which he had recovered and learned his language, had not asked. But the study had progressed. I search for my father, Moengus, Kellis said. Anasarimber Moengus.
Is he lost?
Lewith asked, gratified beyond measure by this admission. No. He left my people long ago while I was still a child.
Then why do you search for him?
Because he sent for me. He asked that I journey to see him. Lewith nodded, as though all sons must return to their fathers at some point.
Where is he?
Kellis paused for a heartbeat, his eyes apparently fixed upon Lewith, but actually focused on an empty point before him. As a cold man might curl into a ball, gather as much skin as possible into his arms and away from the world, Kellis withdrew his surfaces from the room and sheltered within his intellect, unmoved by the press of outer events. The legions within were yoked, the variables isolated and extended, and the welter of possible consequences that might follow upon a truthful answer to Lewith's question bloomed through his soul, the probability trance. He rose, blinked against the firelight. As with so many questions regarding his mission, the answer was incalculable. Shaima, Kella said at length. A city far to the south called Shima.
He sent for you from Shima? But how is that possible?
Kellis adopted a faintly bewildered look that was not far from true.
Through dreams? He sent for me through dreams.
Sorcery.
Always the curious intermingling of awe and dread when Luith uttered this word. There were witches, Luith had told him, whose urgings could harness the wild agencies asleep in earth, animal, and tree. There were priests whose pleas could sound the outside, move the gods who moved the world to give men respite. And there were sorcerers whose assertions were decrees, whose words dictated rather than described how the world had to be. Superstition, everywhere and in everything, Luith had confused that which came after with that which came before, confused the effect for the cause. Men came after, so he placed them before and called them gods or demons. Words came after, so he placed them before and called them scriptures or incantations. Confined to the aftermath of events and blind to the causes that preceded him, he merely fastened upon the ruin itself, men and the acts of men, as the model of what came before. But what came before, the Dunyane had learned, was inhuman.
There must be some other explanation. There is no sorcery.
What do you know of Shima?
Kellis asked. The walls shivered beneath a fierce succession of gusts, and the flame twirled with abrupt incandescence. The hanging pelts lightly rocked to and fro. Luith looked about, his brow furrowed, as though he strained to hear someone.
It's a long way off, Kellis, through dangerous lands.
Shima is not holy for you?
Luith smiled. Like places too near, places too far could never be holy.
I've heard the name only a few times before, he said. The Srank own the north. The few men who remain are endlessly besieged, bound to the cities of Atrathau and Sarkarpus. We know little of the Three Seas.
The Three Seas?
The nations of the south,
Luith replied, his eyes rounded in wonder. He found his ignorance, Kellis knew, godlike.
You mean you've never heard of the Three Seas?
As isolated as your people are, mine are far more so.
Luith nodded sagely. Finally, it was his turn to speak of profound things.
The Three Seas were young when the north was destroyed by the No-God and his consort. Now that we're but a shadow, they're the seat of power for men.
He paused, disheartened by how quickly his knowledge had failed him.
I know little more than that, save a handful of names.
Then how did you learn of Shima?
I once sold ermine to a man from the caravans. A dark-skinned man, a Ketye. Never saw a dark-skinned man before.
Caravans?
Kellis had never heard the word before, but he spoke it as though he wanted to know which caravan the trapper referred to.
Every year a caravan from the south arrives in Atrathau. If it survives the Srank, that is. It travels from a land called Galioth by way of Sarkarpus, bringing spices, silks, wondrous things, Kellis. Have you ever tasted pepper?
What did this dark-skinned man tell you of Shima?
Not much, really. He spoke mostly about his religion. Said he was Inrithi, a follower of the latter prophet, Inri.
His brows knotted for a moment.
Something or another, can you imagine? A latter prophet?
Luith paused, eyes unfocused, struggling to render the episode in words.
He kept saying that I was damned unless I submit to his prophet and open my heart to the thousand temples. I'll never forget that name.
So Shima was holy to this man?
The holiest of holies. It was the city of his prophet long ago, but there was some kind of problem, I think. Something about wars and about heathens having taken it from the Inrithi.
Luith halted, as though struck by something of peculiar significance.
In the Three Seas, men war with men, Kellis, and care nothing for the Srank. Can you imagine?
So Shima is a holy city in the hands of a heathen people?
All for the best, I think,
Lewith replied, abruptly bitter.
The dog kept calling me a heathen as well.
They continued talking of distant lands far into the night. The wind howled and battered the sturdy walls of their cabin, and in the gloom of a faltering fire, Anasarimber Kellis slowly drew Lewith into his own descending rhythms, slower breath, drowsy eyes. When the trapper was fully entranced, he peeled away his last secrets, hunted him until no refuge remained. Alone, Kellis snowshoed through frigid stands of spruce and toward the nearest of the heights that surrounded the trapper's cabin. Snowdrifts scrawled around the dark trunks. The air smelled of winter silence. Kellis had refashioned himself over the past several weeks. The forest was no longer the stupefying cacophony it had once been. Sobel was a land of winter caribou, sable, beaver, and marten. Amber slumbered in her ground. Bare stone lay clean beneath her sky, and her lakes were silver with fish. There was nothing more, nothing worthy of awe or dread. Before him, the snow fell away from a shallow cliff. Kellis stared up, searching for the path that would see the heights yield to him most readily. He climbed. Except for a few stunted and leafless hawthorns, the summit was clear. At its center stood an ancient stele, a stone shaft leaning against the distance. Runes and small graven figures pitted all four sides. What drew Kellis here, time and again, was not merely the language of the graven text. Aside from the idiom, it was indistinguishable from his own, but the name of its author. It began,
"And I, Anasarimber Kelmomus II, look from this place and witness the glory worked by my hand,"
and continue to catalog a great battle between long-dead kings. According to Lewith, this land had once been the frontier of two nations, Kunaiuri and Iemnur, both lost millennia ago in mythical wars against what Lewith called the No-God. As with many of Lewith's stories, Kellis dismissed his tales of the apocalypse outright. But the name, Anasarimber, engraved in ancient diorite, was something he could not dismiss. The world, he now understood, was far older than the Dunyane, and if his bloodline extended as far as this dead high king, then so was he. But such thoughts were irrelevant to his mission. His study of Lewith was drawing to conclusion. Soon he would have to continue south to Atrathau, where Lewith had insisted he could secure further means of traveling to Shima. From the heights, Kellis looked south across the winter forests. Ishual lay somewhere behind him, hidden in the glacial mountains. Before him lay a pilgrimage through a world of men bound by arbitrary custom, by the endless repetition of tribal lies. He would come to them as one awake. He would shelter in the hollows of their ignorance, and through truth he would make them his instruments. He was Dunyane, one of the conditioned, and he would possess all peoples, all circumstances. He would come before. But another Dunyane awaited him, one who had studied the wilderness far longer, Moengus.
"How great is your power, father?"
Turning from the panorama, he noticed something odd. On the far side of the stele, he saw tracks in the snow. He studied them momentarily before resolving to ask the trapper about them. Their author had walked upright, but had not been quite human.
"They look like this," Kellis said. With a bare finger, he quickly pressed a replica of the track in the snow.
Lewith watched him, his manner stern. Kellis needed only to glance at him to see the horror he tried to hide. In the background, the dogs yelped, trotted circles at the ends of their leather leashes.
"Where?"
Lewith asked, staring intently at the strange track.
"The old Kunaiuric stele. They move at a tangent to the cabin, to the northwest."
The bearded face turned to him.
"And you don't know what these tracks are?"
The significance of the question was plain. "You're from the north, and you don't know these?" Then Kellis understood.
"Srank," he said.
The trapper looked beyond him,
sifting through the surrounding wall of trees. The monk registered the flutter in the man's bowels, his quickening heartbeat, and the litany of his thoughts, too quick to be a question. What do we do? What do we do? We should follow the tracks, Kellis said. Make sure they don't cross your runs. If they do...
It's been a hard winter for them, Lewith said.
He needed to wring some significance from his terror.
They've come south for food. They hunt food. Yes, food.
And if not?
Lewith glanced at him, eyes wild.
For Srank, men are a sustenance of a different sort. They hunt us to calm the madness of their hearts.
He stepped among his dogs, was distracted by their accumulation around his legs.
Quiet, shh, quiet.
He slapped their ribs, pressed their chins to the snow by vigorously rubbing the backs of their heads. His arms swung wide and randomly, dispensing his affection among them equally.
Could you bring me the muzzles, Kellis?
The trail was thin and gray through the drifts. The sky darkened. Winter evenings brought a strange hush to the interior of the forest, the sense that something greater than daylight was drawing to conclusion. They had run far in their snowshoes, and now they stopped. They stood beneath the desolate limbs of an oak.
We shouldn't return, Kellis said.
But we can't leave the dogs.
The monk watched Lewith for several breaths. Their exhalations fell on hard air. He could easily dissuade the trapper, he knew, from returning for anything. Whatever it was they followed knew of the runs, and perhaps even of the cabin itself. But tracks in the snow, empty marks, were far too little for him to use. For Kellis, the threat existed only in the fear manifested by the trapper. The forest was still his. Kellis turned, and together they made for the cabin, running with the shambling grace of snowshoes. But after a short distance, Kellis halted the man with a firm hand on his shoulder.
What?
The trapper began to ask, but he was silenced by the sounds. A chorus of muffled howls and shrieks perforated the quiet. A single yelp pierced the hollows, followed by dread, wintry silence. Lewith stood as still as the dark trees.
Why, Kellis?
His voice cracked. There's no time for why. We must flee. Kellis sat in ashen gloom, watching the dawn's rosy fingers poke through thickets of branch and dark pine. Lewith still slept.
We've run hard, Father, but have we run hard enough?
He saw something, a movement quickly obscured by the forest depths.
Lewith,
he said. The trapper stirred.
What?
The man said, coughing.
It's still dark.
Another figure, farther to the left. Closing. Kellis remained still, his eyes lost in explorations of the wooded recesses.
They come,
he said. Lewith bent forward from his frozen blankets. His face was ashen. Bewildered, he followed Kellis's gaze into the surrounding gloom.
I see nothing.
They move with stealth.
Lewith began shivering.
Run,
Kellis said. Lewith stared at him in astonishment.
Run? The Srank run down everything, Kellis. You don't flee them. They're too fast.
I know, Kellis replied. I'll remain here. Slow them.
Lewith could only stare at him. He could not move. The trees thundered about him. The sky tugged with its emptiness. Then an arrow jutted through his shoulder, and he fell to his knees, stared at the red tip protruding from his breast.
Kellis!
He gasped. But Kellis was gone. Lewith rolled in the snow, searching for him, found him sprinting through the near trees, a sword in his hand. The first of the Srank was beheaded, and the monk moved like a pale wraith through the drifts. Another died, its knife sketching uselessly through open air. The others closed upon Kellis like leathery shadows.
Kellis!
Lewith cried, perhaps out of anguish, perhaps hoping to draw them away toward one who was already dead.
I would die for you.
But the forms fell, clutching themselves in the snow, and a weird, inhuman howl rifled through the trees. More fell, until only the tall monk was left. Far away, the trapper thought he heard his dogs barking.
Kellis pulled him along. Points of snow winked in the rising sun as they crashed through the thickets. Lewith felt cramped around the agony in his shoulder, but the monk was relentless, yanked him to a pace he could scarcely have managed uninjured. They blundered through drifts around trees, half-tumbled into ravines, and clawed their way out again. The monk and his arms were always there, a thin rack of iron that propped him again and again. He still thought he could hear dogs.
My dogs.
At last he was thrown against a tree. The tree behind him felt a pillar of stone, a prop to die against. He could scarcely distinguish Kellis, his beard and hood clotted with ice, from the canopy of bare branches.
Lewith, Kellis was saying, you must think.
Cruel words. They grasped him to clarity, thrust him against his anguish.
My dogs, he sobbed. I hear them.
The blue eyes acknowledged nothing. More Srank come, Kellis said between labored breaths. We need shelter, a place to hide. Lewith rolled his head back, swallowed at the spike of pain in the back of his throat, tried to gather himself.
What direction have we come?
South, always south. Lewith pushed himself from the tree, hugged the monk's shoulders. He was seized by uncontrollable shivers. He coughed and peered through the trees.
How many streams?
He sucked air.
Streams have we crossed?
He felt the heat of Kellis's breath. Five.
West,
he gasped. He leaned back to look into the monk's face, still clutching him. He did not feel shame. There was no shame with this man.
We must go west,
he continued, putting his forehead to the monk's lips.
Ruins, ruins, non-men ruins, many places to hide.
He groaned. The world wheeled.
You can see it a short distance from here.
Lewith felt snowy ground slam into his body. Stunned, all he could do was curl into his knees. Through the trees he saw Kellis's figure, distorted by tears, recede amidst the trees.
No, no, no,
he sobbed.
Kellis? Kellis! What's happening? No!
He shrieked. The tall figure vanished. The slope was treacherous. Kellis hauled himself up by grasping limbs and securing his step in the deadfalls beneath the snow. The conifers begrudged any clear path across the pitched ground. Radial scaffolds of branches tore at him. A gloom unlike the pale of winter thatched his surroundings. When he at last climbed free of the forest, the monk scowled at the sky and found himself stilled by the vista above him. Snow-covered, the ground rose with the hungry contours of a dog. The ruins of a gate and a wall towered over the nearer slopes. Beyond it, a dead oak of immense proportions bent against the sky. Rain fell from dark clouds scrolling over the summit, froze against his coats. Kellis was astonished by the great stones of the gate. Many had a girth as huge as the oak they obscured. An uplifted face had been hewn from the lintel. Blank eyes, as patient as sky. He passed beneath. The ground leveled somewhat. Behind him, the expanses of forest grew dim in the gathering rain. But the noise grew louder. The tree had been long dead. Its colossal tendons were husked of their bark, and its limbs extended into the air like winding tusks. Stripped of its detail, the wind and rain sluiced through it with ease. He turned as the Srank broke from the bush, howling as they loped across the snow. So clear, this place. Arrows hissed by him. He picked one from the air and studied it. Warm, as though it had been pressed against skin. Then his sword was in his hand, and it glittered through the space around him, seizing it like the branches of a tree. They came, a dark rush, and he was there before them. Poised in the one moment they could not foresee. A calligraphy of cries. The thud of astonished flesh. He speared the ecstasy from their inhuman faces, stepped among them, and snuffed out their beating hearts. They could not see that circumstance was holy. They only hungered. He, on the other hand, was one of the conditioned, Dunyane, and all events yielded to him. They fell back, and the howling subsided. They thronged for a moment around him, narrow shoulders and dog-shaped chests, stinking leather and necklaces of human teeth. He stood patient before their menace, tranquil. They fled. He bent to one that still squirmed at his feet, lifting it by its throat, the beautiful face contorted with fury.
Kuzinarishka dazudaka gorankas.
It spat at him. He nailed it to the tree with his sword. He stepped back. It shrieked, flailed. What are these creatures? A horse snorted behind him, stamped at the snow and ice. Kellis retrieved his sword and whirled. Through the sleet, the horse and rider were mere gray shapes. Kellis watched their slow approach, standing his ground, his shaggy hair frozen into little tusks that clicked in the wind. The horse was large, some 18 hands, and black. Its rider was draped in a long gray cloak stitched with faint patterns, abstracts of faces. He wore an uncrested helm that obscured his countenance. A powerful voice rang out in Kunayurik.
I can see that you're not to be killed.
Kellis was silent, watchful, the sound of rain like blowing sand. The figure dismounted but maintained a wary distance. He studied the inert form sprawled around them.
Extraordinary,
the stranger said, then looked to him. Kellis could see the glitter of his eyes beneath the brow of his helm.
You must be a name.
Anasarimber Kellis, the monk replied. Silence. Kellis thought he could sense confusion, strange confusion.
It speaks the language,
the man muttered at length. He stepped closer, peering at Kellis.
Yes, he said. Yes, you do not merely mock me. I can see his blood in your face.
Kellis again was silent.
You have the patience of an Anasarimbor as well.
Kellis studied him, noting that his cloak was not stitched with stylized representations of faces, but with actual faces, their features distorted by being stretched flat. Beneath the cloak, the man was powerfully built, heavily armored, and from the way he comported himself, entirely unafraid.
I see that you are a student. Knowledge is power, eh?
This one was not like Lewith. Not at all. Still, the sound of sleet, patiently drawing the dead into the cold snow.
Should you not fear me, mortal, knowing what I am? Fear, too, is power. The power to survive.
The figure began to circle him, carefully stepping between shrank limbs.
This is what separates your kind from mine. Fear. The clawing, grubbing impulse to survive. For us, life is always a decision. For you, well, let us just say, it decides.
At last, Kellis spoke. The decision, then, would seem to be yours.
The figure paused. Ah, mockery, he said sorrowfully. That is one thing we share.
Kellis's provocation had been deliberate, but had yielded little, or so it seemed at first. The stranger abruptly lowered his obscured face, rolled his head back and forth on the pivot of his chin, muttering,
It baits me. The mortal baits me. It reminds me. Reminds.
He began fumbling with his cloak, seized upon a misshapen face.
Of this one. Oh, impertinent. What a joy this one was. Yes, I remember.
He looked up at Kellis and hissed,
I remember.
And Kellis grasped the first principles of this encounter. A non-man, another of Lewith's myths come true. With solemn deliberation, the figure drew his broadsword. It shined unnaturally in the gloom, as though reflecting some otherworldly sun. But he turned to one of the dead Srank, rolled it onto its back with the flat of the blade. Its white skin was beginning to darken.
This Srank here, you could not pronounce its name, was our Elju, our book,
you would say in your tongue. A most devoted animal. I'd be wrecked without it. For a time, anyway. He surveyed the other dead. Nasty, vicious creatures, really. He looked back up to Kellis. But most memorable.
An opening. Kellis would explore. He said, so reduced. You've become so pitiful.
You pity me? A dog dares pity?
The non-man laughed harshly.
The Anasarimbo pities me, and so he should. Kakunoroi sukielju sukushila.
He spat, then gestured with his sword to the surrounding dead.
These rank are our children now. But before you were our children, our heart had been cut out, and so we cradled yours, companions to the great Norserai kings.
The non-man stepped nearer.
But no longer, he continued. As the ages waxed, some of us needed more than your childish squabbles to remember. Some of us needed a more exquisite brutality than any of your feuds could render. The great curse of our kind, do you know it? Of course you know it. What slave fails to exult in his master's degradation, hm?
The wind wrapped his hoary cloak about him. He took another step.
But I make excuses like a man. Losses written into the very earth. We are only its most dramatic reminder.
The non-man had raised the point of his sword to Kellis, who had fallen into stance, his own curved sword poised above his head. Again, silence. Deadly this time.
I am a warrior of ages, Anasarimba. Ages. I have dipped my Nymol in 1,000 hearts. I have ridden both against and for the No-God in the great wars that offered this wilderness. I have scaled the ramparts of great Golgotharoth, watched the hearts of high kings break for fury.
Then why, Kellis asked, raise arms now against a lone man? Laughter. The free hand gestured to the dead Srank.
A pittance, I agree, but still you would be memorable.
Kellis struck first, but his blade recoiled from the mail beneath the non-man's cloak. He crouched, deflected the powerful counterstroke, swept the figure's legs out from beneath him. The non-man toppled backward but managed to roll effortlessly back to his feet. Laughter rang from the helmed face.
Most memorable,
he cried, falling upon the monk. And Kellis felt himself pressed. A rain of mighty blows, forcing him back, away from the dead tree. The ring of Dunyane steel and non-man Nymol pealed across the windswept heights. But Kellis could sense the moment, although it was far, far thinner than it had been with the Srank. He climbed into that narrow instant, and the unearthly blade fell farther and farther from its mark, bit deeper into empty air. Then Kellis's own sword was scoring the dark figure, clipping and prodding the armor, tattering the grim cloak, but he could draw no blood.
What are you?
The non-man cried in fury. There was one space between them, but the crossings were infinite. Kellis opened the non-man's exposed chin. Blood, black in the gloom, spilled across his breast. A second stroke sent the uncanny blade skittering across snow and ice. As Kellis leapt, the non-man scrambled backward, fell. The point of Kellis's sword, poised above the opening of his helm, stilled him. In the freezing rain, the monk breathed evenly, staring down at the fallen figure. Several instants passed. Now the interrogation could begin. You will answer my questions, Kellis instructed, his tone devoid of passion. The non-man laughed darkly.
But it is you, Anasarimba, who are the question.
And then came the word. The word that, on hearing, wrenched the intellect somehow. A furious incandescence. Like a petal blown from a palm, Kellis was thrown backward. He rolled through the snow and, stunned, struggled to his feet. He watched numbly as the non-man was drawn upright as though by a wire. Pale, watery light formed a sphere around him. The ice rain sputtered and hissed against it. Behind him rose the great tree. Sorcery? But how could it be? Kellis fled, sprinted over the dead structures, breaking the snow. He slipped on ice and skidded over the far side of the heights, toppled through the wicked branches of trees. He recovered his feet and tore himself through the harsh underbrush. Something like a thunderclap shivered through the air, and great blinding fires rifled through the spruces behind him. The heat washed over him, and he ran harder, until the slopes were leaps and the dark forest a rush of confusion.
Anasarimba,
an unearthly voice called, cracking the winter silence.
Run, Anasarimba,
it boomed.
I will remember.
Laughter, like a storm, and the forest behind him was harrowed by more fierce lights. They fractured the surrounding gloom, and Kellis could see his own fleeing shadow flickering before him. The cold air racked his lungs, but he ran, far harder than the Srank had made him run. Sorcery? Is this among the lessons I'm to learn, Father? Cold night fell. Somewhere in the dark, wolves howled. Shima, they seemed to say, was too far. Part 1. The Sorcerer. Chapter 1. Carathuzel. There are three and only three kinds of men in the world: cynics, fanatics, and mandate schoolmen. Antillus, On the Folly of Men. The author has often observed that in the genesis of great events, men generally possess no inkling of what their actions portend. This problem is not, as one might suppose, a result of men's blindness to the consequences of their actions. Rather, it is a result of the mad way the dreadful turns on the trivial when the ends of one man cross the ends of another. The schoolmen of the Scarlet Spires have an old saying, "When one man chases a hare, he finds a hare. But when many men chase a hare, they find a dragon." In the prosecution of competing human interests, the result is always unknown, and all too often terrifying. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Midwinter, 4110, Year of the Tusk, Carathuzel. All spies obsessed over their informants. It was a game they played in the moments before sleep or even during nervous gaps in conversation. A spy would look at his informant, as Acamian looked at Gishruni now, and ask himself, "How much does he know?" Like many taverns found near the edge of the Worm, the great slums of Carathuzel, the holy leper was at once luxurious and impoverished. The floor was tiled with ceramics as fine as any found in the palace of a Palatine governor, but the walls were of painted mud brick, and the ceiling was so low that taller men had to duck beneath the brass lamps, which were authentic imitations, Acamian had once heard the owner boast, of those found in the temple of Exorieta. The place was invariably crowded, filled with shadowy, sometimes dangerous men, but the wine and hashish were just expensive enough to prevent those who could not afford to bathe from rubbing shoulders with those who could. Until coming to the holy leper, Acamian had never liked the Ainani, especially those from Carathuzel. Like most in the Three Seas, he thought them vain and effeminate, too much oil in their beards, too fond of irony and cosmetics, too reckless in their sexual habits. But this estimation had changed after the endless hours he'd spent waiting for Gishruni to arrive. The subtlety of character and taste that afflicted only the highest castes of other nations, he realized, was a rampant fever among these people, infecting even low-caste freemen and slaves. He had always thought High Anon a nation of libertines and petty conspirators. That this made them a nation of kindred spirits was something he never had imagined. Perhaps this was why he failed to immediately recognize his peril when Gishruni said, "I know you." Dark even in the lamplight, Gishruni lowered his arms, which had been folded across his white silk vest, and leaned forward in his seat. He was an imposing figure, possessing a hawkish soldier's face, a beard pleated into what looked like black leather straps, and thick arms so deeply tanned that one could see but never quite decipher the line of Ainani pictograms tattooed from shoulder to wrist. Akamian tried to grin affably. "You and my wives," he said, tossing back yet another bowl of wine. He gasped and smacked his lips. Gishruni had always been, or so Akamian had assumed, a narrow man, one for whom the grooves of thought and word were few and deep. Most warriors were such, particularly when they were slaves. But there had been nothing narrow about his claim. Gishruni watched him carefully, the suspicion in his eyes rounded by a faint wonder. He shook his head in disgust.
"I should have said, I know who you are."
The man leaned back in a contemplative way so foreign to a soldier's manner that Akamian's skin pimpled with dread. The rumbling tavern receded, became a frame of shadowy figures and points of golden lantern light.
"Then write it down," Akamian replied, as though growing bored, "and give it to me when I'm sober."
He looked away, as bored men often do, and noted that the entrance to the tavern was empty.
"I know you have no wives."
"You don't say, and how's that?"
Akamian glanced quickly behind him, glimpsed a whore laughing as she pressed a shiny silver ensilari onto her sweaty breasts. The vulgar crowd about her roared,
"One!" "She's quite good at that, you know. She uses honey."
Gishruni was not distracted.
"Your kind aren't allowed to have wives."
"My kind, eh? And just what is my kind?"
Another glance at the entrance.
"You're a sorcerer, a schoolman."
Akamian laughed, knowing his momentary hesitation had betrayed him. But there was motive enough to continue this pantomime. At the very least, it might buy him several more moments, time to stay alive.
"By the latter fucking prophet, my friend," Akamian cried, glancing once again at the entrance. "I swear I could measure your accusations by the bowl. What was it you accused me of being last night? A whore son?"
Amid chortling voices, a thunderous shout.
"Two!"
The fact that Gishruni grimaced told Akamian little. The man's every expression seemed some version of a grimace, particularly his smile. The hand that flashed out and clamped his wrist, however, told Akamian all he needed to know.
"I'm doomed. They know."
Few things were more terrifying than they, especially in Carathuzal. They were the Scarlet Spires, the most powerful school in the Three Seas, and the hidden masters of High Anon. Gishruni was a captain of the Javra, the warrior slaves of the Scarlet Spires, which is why Akamian had courted him over the past few weeks. This is what spies do, woo the slaves of their competitors. Gishruni stared fiercely into his eyes, twisted his hand palm outward.
"There's a way for us to satisfy my suspicion," the man said softly.
"Three!"
reverberated across mud brick and scuffed mahogany. Akamian winced, both because of the man's powerful grip and because he knew the way Gishruni referred to.
"Not like this."
"Gishruni, please. You're drunk, my friend. What school would hazard the wrath of the Scarlet Spires?"
Gishruni shrugged.
"The Maisunsei, maybe, or the Imperial Sake, the Kisarum. There are so many of your accursed kind. But if I had to wager, I would say the Mandate. I would say you're a Mandate schoolman."
Canny slave, how long had he known? The impossible words were there, poised in Akamian's thought, words that could blind eyes and blister flesh.
"He leaves me no choice."
There would be an uproar. Men would bellow, clutch their swords, but they would do nothing but scramble from his path. More than any people in the Three Seas, the Ainani feared sorcery.
"No choice."
But Gishruni had already reached beneath his embroidered vest, his fist bunched beneath the fabric. He grimaced like a grinning jackal.
"Too late."
"You look,"
Gishruni said with menacing ease, "like you have something to say." The man withdrew his hand and produced the koray. He winked, then with terrifying abruptness, snapped the golden chain, holding it about his neck. A Kamian had sensed it from their first encounter, had actually used its unnerving murmur to identify Gishruni's vocation. Now Gishruni would use it to identify him.
"What's this now?"
a Kamian asked. A shudder of animal terror passed through his pinned arm.
"I think you know, Akka. I think you know far better than I."
Koray. Schoolmen called them trinkets. Small names are often given to horrifying things. But for other men, those who followed the Thousand Temples in condemning sorcery as blasphemy, they were called Tears of God. But the god had no hand in their manufacture. Koray were relics of the ancient north, so valuable that only the marriage of heirs, murder, or the tribute of entire nations could purchase them. They were worth the price. Koray rendered their bearers immune to sorcery and killed any sorcerer unfortunate enough to touch them. Effortlessly holding a Kamian's hand immobile, Gishruni raised the koray between thumb and forefinger. It looked plain enough, a small sphere of iron about the size of an olive, but encased in the cursive script of the non-men. A Kamian could feel it tug at his bowels, as though Gishruni held an absence rather than a thing, a small pit in the very fabric of the world. His heart hammered in his ears. He thought of the knife sheathed beneath his tunic.
"Four!"
Raucous laughter. He struggled to free his captive hand. Futile.
"Gishruni!"
"Every captain of the Javra is given one of these,"
Gishruni said, his tone at once reflective and proud.
"But then, you already know this.
All this time he's been playing me for a fool. How could I have missed it?"
"Your masters are kind," a Kamian said, riveted by the horror suspended above his palm.
"Kind?" Gishruni spat. "The Scarlet Spires are not kind. They're ruthless, cruel to those who oppose them."
And for the first time, a Kamian glimpsed the torment animating the man, the anguish in his bright eyes.
"What's happening here?"
He hazarded a question.
"And to those who serve them?"
"They do not discriminate."
"They don't know. Only Gishruni."
"Five!"
pealed beneath the low ceilings. A Kamian licked his lips.
"What do you want, Gishruni?"
The warrior slave looked down at Akamian's trembling palm, then lowered the trinket as though he were a child, curious of what might happen. Simply staring at it made Akamian dizzy, jerked bile to the back of his throat.
Koray,
a tear drawn from the god's own cheek. Death, death to all blasphemers.
"What do you want?"
Akamian hissed.
"What all men want, Akka. Truth."
All the things Akamian had seen, all the trials he'd survived, lay pinched in that narrow space between his shining palm and the oiled iron.
Trinket.
Death poised between the calloused fingers of a slave. But Akamian was a schoolman, and for schoolmen, nothing, not even life itself, was as precious as the truth.
They were its miserly keepers, and they warred for its possession across all the shadowy grottos of the three seas. Better to die than to yield mandate truth to the Scarlet Spires. But there was more here. Gishruni was alone. Akamian was certain of this. Sorcerers could see sorcerers, see the bruise of their crimes, and the holy leper hosted no sorcerers. No scarlet schoolmen, only drunks making wagers with whores. Gishruni played this game on his own.
But for what mad reason?
"Tell him what he wants. He already knows."
"I'm a mandate schoolman,"
a Kamian whispered quickly. Then he added,
"A spy."
Dangerous words, but what choice did he have? Gishruni studied him for a breathless moment, then slowly gathered the koray into his fist. He released Akamian's hand. There was an odd moment of silence, interrupted only by the clatter of a silver insulari against wood. A roar of laughter and a hoarse voice bellowed,
"You lose, whore!"
But this, Akamiya knew, was not so. Somehow, he had won this night, and he had won the way whores always win, without understanding. After all, spies were little different from whores, sorcerers less so. Though he had dreamt of being a sorcerer as a child, the possibility of being a spy had never occurred to Drusus Akamian. Spy simply wasn't part of the vocabulary of children raised in Enrani fishing villages. For him, the three seas had possessed only two dimensions in his childhood. There were places far and near, and there were people high and low. He would listen to the old fishwives tell their tales while he and the other children helped shuck oysters, and he learned very quickly that he was among the low, and that mighty people dwelt far away. Name after mysterious name would fall from those old lips. The Shrya of the Thousand Temples, the malevolent heathens of Kian, the all-conquering Skilvendi, the scheming sorcerers of the Scarlet Spires, and so on. Names that sketched the dimensions of his world, infused it with terrifying majesty, transformed it into an arena of impossibly tragic and heroic deeds. He would fall asleep, feeling very small. One might think becoming a spy would add dimension to the simple world of a child, but precisely the opposite was the case. Certainly, as he matured, Akamian's world became more complicated. He learned that there were things holy and unholy, that the gods and the outside possessed their own dimensions, rather than being people very high and a place very far. He also learned that there were times recent and ancient, that a long time ago was not like another place, but rather a queer kind of ghost that haunted every place. But when one became a spy, the world had the curious habit of collapsing into a single dimension. High-born men, even emperors and kings, had the habit of seeming as base and as petty as the most vulgar fishermen. Faraway nations like Conraya, High Anon, Setadon, or Kian no longer seemed exotic or enchanted, but were as grubby and as weathered as an Enrani fishing village. Things holy, like the Tusk, the Thousand Temples, or even the Latter Prophet, became mere versions of things unholy, like the Fenim, the Kisharim, or the sorceress schools, as though the words holy and unholy were as easily exchanged as seats at a gaming table. And the recent simply became a more tawdry repetition of the ancient. As both a schoolman and a spy, Akamian had crisscrossed the three seas, had seen many of those things that had once made his stomach flutter with supernatural dread, and he knew now that childhood stories were always better. Since being identified as one of the few as a youth and taken to Atyrsis to be trained by the School of Mandate, he had educated princes, insulted grand masters, and infuriated shrial priests. And he now knew with certainty that the world was hollowed of its wonder by knowledge and travel, that when one stripped away the mysteries, its dimensions collapsed rather than bloomed. Of course, the world was a much more sophisticated place to him now than it had been when he was a child, but it was also far simpler. Everywhere men grasped and grasped, as though the titles king, Shrya, and Grand Master were simply masks worn by the same hungry animal. Avarice, it seemed to him, was the world's only dimension. Akamian was a middle-aged sorcerer and spy, and he had grown weary of both vocations. And though he would be loath to admit it, he was heartsick. As the old fishwives might say, he had dragged one empty net too many. Perplexed and dismayed, Akamian left Gishruni at the Holy Leper and hurried home, if it could be called that, through the shadowy ways of the worm. Extending from the northern banks of the river Sayut to the famed Sermantic Gates, the worm was a labyrinth of crumbling tenements, brothels, and impoverished cultic temples. The place was aptly named, Akamian had always thought. Humid, riddled by cramped alleys, the worm indeed resembled something found beneath a rock. Given his mission, Akamian had no reason to be dismayed. Quite the opposite, if anything. After the mad moment with the Kore, Gashruni had told him secrets, potent secrets. Gashruni, it turned out, was not a happy slave. He hated the Scarlet Magi with an intensity that was almost frightening once revealed.
I didn't befriend you for the promise of your gold, the Javra captain had said. For what? To buy my freedom from my masters? The Scarlet Spires relinquish nothing of value. No. I befriended you because I knew you would be useful.
Useful? But for what end?
Vengeance. I would humble the Scarlet Spires.
So you knew. All along you knew I was no merchant. Sneering laughter.
Of course. You were too free with your ancillaries.
Sit with a merchant or sit with a beggar, and it'll always be the beggar who buys your first drink.
What kind of spy are you?
Akamian had scowled at this, scowled at his own transparency. But as much as Geshruni's penetration troubled him, he was terrified by the degree to which he'd misjudged the man. Gashruni was a warrior and a slave. What surer formula could there be for stupidity? But slaves, Akamian supposed, had good reason to conceal their intelligence. A wise slave was something to be prized, perhaps, like the slave scholars of the old Canaan Empire. A cunning slave, however, was something to be feared, to be eliminated. But this thought held little consolation. If he could fool me so easily. Akamian had plucked a great secret out of the obscurity of Carathusel and the Scarlet Spires, the greatest, perhaps, in many years. But he did not have his ability, which he'd rarely questioned over the years, to thank. Only his incompetence. As a result, he'd learned two secrets. One dreadful enough, he supposed, in the greater scheme of the three seas, the other dreadful within the frame of his life. I'm not, he realized, the man I once was. Gishruni's story had been alarming in its own right, if only because it demonstrated the ability of the Scarlet Spires to harbor secrets. The Scarlet Spires, Gishruni said, was at war, had been, for more than 10 years, in fact. Akamian had been unimpressed, at first. The sorceress schools, like all the great factions, ceaselessly skirmished with spies, assassinations, trade sanctions, and delegations of outraged envoys. But this war, Gashruni assured him, was far more momentous than any skirmish.
10 years ago, Gashruni said, our former Grand Master, Sashioka, was assassinated.
Sashioka? Akamian was not inclined to ask stupid questions, but the idea that a Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires could be assassinated was preposterous. How could such a thing happen?
Assassinated? In the inner sanctums of the spires themselves.
In other words, in the midst of the most formidable system of wards in the three seas, not only would the Mandate never dare such an act, but there was no way, even with the glittering abstractions of the Gnosis, they could succeed. Who could do such a thing?
By whom?
Akamian asked, almost breathless. Geshruni's eyes actually twinkled in the ruddy lamplight.
By the heathens, he said. The Kishorum.
Akamian was at once baffled and gratified by this revelation. The Kishorum, the only heathen school. At least this explained Sashioka's assassination. There was a saying common to the three seas. Only the few can see the few. Sorcery was violent. To speak it was to cut the world as surely as if with a knife. But only the few, sorcerers, could see this mutilation, and only they could see, moreover, the blood on the hands of the mutilator, the mark, as it was called. Only the few could see one another and one another's crimes, and when they met, they recognized one another as surely as common men recognized criminals by their lack of a nose. Not so with the Kisharum. No one knew why or how, but they worked events as grand and as devastating as any sorcery without marking the world or bearing the mark of their crime. Only once had Akamian witnessed Kisharum sorcery, what they called the Suka, on a night long ago in distant Shima. With the Gnosis, the sorcery of the ancient north, He destroyed his saffron-robed assailants, but as he sheltered behind his wards, it had seemed as though he watched flashes of soundless lightning. No thunder, no mark. Only the few could see the few, but no one, no schoolman at least, could distinguish the Kisharim or their works from common men or the common world. And it was this, Akamian surmised, that had allowed them to assassinate Sashioka. The Scarlet Spires possessed wards for sorcerers, slave soldiers like Kishruni for men bearing Kore, but they had nothing to protect them against sorcerers indistinguishable from common men, or against sorcery indistinguishable from the god's own world. Hounds, Kishruni would tell him, now ran freely through the halls of the Scarlet Spires, trained to smell the saffron and henna the Kisharim used to dye their robes. But why? What could induce the Kisharim to wage open war against the Scarlet Spires? As alien as their metaphysics were, they could have no hope of winning such a war. The Scarlet Spires were simply too powerful. When Akamian had asked Kishruni, the slave soldier simply shrugged. It's been a decade, and still they don't know. This at least was grounds for petty comfort. There was nothing the ignorant prized more than the ignorance of others. Drusus Akamian walked ever deeper into the worm toward the squalid tenement where he'd taken a room, still more afraid of himself than his future. Kishruni grimaced as he stumbled out of the tavern. He steadied himself on the packed dust of the alley. Done, he muttered, then cackled in a way he never dared show others. He looked up at a narrow slot of sky, hemmed and obscured by mud-brick walls and ragged canvas awnings. He could see few stars. Suddenly, his betrayal struck him as a pathetic thing. He had told the only real secret he knew to an enemy of his master's. Now, there was nothing left, no treason that might quiet the hatred in his heart. And a bitter hatred it was. More than anything else, Kishruni was a proud man. That someone such as he might be born a slave, be dogged by the desires of weak-hearted, womanish men, by sorcerers. In another life, he knew, he would have been a conqueror. He would have broken enemy after enemy with the might of his hand. But in this accursed life, all he could do was skulk about with other womanish men and gossip. Where was the vengeance in gossip? He'd staggered some way down the alley before realizing that someone followed him. The possibility that his masters had discovered his small treachery struck him momentarily, but he thought it unlikely. The worm was filled with wolves, desperate men who followed mark after mark searching for those drunk enough to be safely plundered. Kishruni had actually killed one once, several years before. Some poor fool who had risked murder rather than sell himself, as Kishruni's nameless father had, into slavery. He continued walking, his senses as keen as the wine would allow, his drunken thoughts reeling through scenario after bloody scenario. This would be a good night, he thought, to kill. Only when he passed beneath the looming facade of the temple the Karathusalai called the Mouth of the Worm did Kishruni become alarmed. Men were quite often followed into the worm, but rarely were they followed out. Above the welter of rooftops, Kishruni could even glimpse the highest of the spires, crimson against a field of stars. Who would dare follow him this far? If not, he whirled and saw a balding, rotund man dressed, despite the heat, in an ornate silk overcoat that might have been any combination of colors, but looked blue and black in the darkness. You are one of the fools with a whore, Kishruni said, trying to shake away the confusion of drink.
Yes,
the man replied, his jowls grinning with his lips.
She was most enticing. But truth be told, I was far more interested in what you had to say to the Mandate Schoolman.
Kishruni squinted in drunken astonishment. So they know. Danger always sobered him. Instinctively, he reached into his pocket, closed his fingers about his kore. He flung it violently at the schoolman, or at who he thought was a scarlet schoolman. The stranger picked the trinket from the air as though it had been tossed for his friendly perusal. He studied it momentarily, a dubious money changer with a leaden coin. He looked up and smiled again, blinking his large bovine eyes.
"A most precious gift," he said. "I thank you, but I'm afraid it's not quite a fair exchange for what I want."
"Not a sorcerer." Gishruni had seen a Kore touch a sorcerer once, the incandescent unraveling of flesh and bone. But then, what was this man?
"Who are you?"
Gishruni asked.
"Nothing you could understand, slave."
The Javra captain smiled. "Maybe he's just a fool." A dangerous, drunken amiability seized his manner. He walked up to the man, placed a calloused hand on his padded shoulder. He could smell jasmine. The cow-like eyes looked up at him.
"Oh, my,"
the stranger whispered.
"You are a daring fool, aren't you?"
Why isn't he afraid? Remembering the ease with which the man had snatched the Kore, Gishruni suddenly felt horribly exposed. But he was committed.
"Who are you?"
Gishruni grated. "How long have you been watching me?"
"Watching you?"
The fat man almost giggled.
"Such conceit is unbecoming of slaves."
"He watches a Kamian? What is this?" Gishruni was an officer, accustomed to cowing men in the menacing intimacy of a face-to-face confrontation. Not this man. Soft or not, he was at utter ease. Gishruni could feel it. And if it weren't for the unwatered wine, he would have been terrified. He dug his fingers deep into the fat of the man's shoulder.
"I said, tell me, fat fool," he hissed between clenched teeth, "or I'll muck up the dust with your bowel."
With his free hand, he brandished his knife.
"Who are you?"
Unperturbed, the fat man grinned with sudden ferocity.
"Few things are as distressing as a slave who refuses to acknowledge his place."
Stunned, Gishruni looked down at his senseless hand, watched his knife flop onto the dust. All he'd heard was the snap of the stranger's sleeve.
"Heal, slave,"
the fat man said.
"What did you say?"
The slap stung him, brought tears to his eyes.
"I said, heal."
Another slap, hard enough to loosen teeth. Gishruni stumbled back several steps, raising a clumsy hand.
How could this be?
"What a task we've set for ourselves,"
the stranger said ruefully, following him,
"when even their slaves possess such pride."
Panicked, Gishruni fumbled for the hilt of his sword. The fat man paused, his eyes flashing to the pommel.
"Draw it,"
he said, his voice impossibly cold, inhuman. Wide-eyed, Gishruni froze, transfixed by the silhouette that loomed before him.
"I said, draw it."
Gishruni hesitated. The next slap knocked him to his knees.
"What are you?"
Gishruni cried through bloodied lips. As the shadow of the fat man encompassed him, Gishruni watched his round face loosen, then flex as tight as a beggar's hand about copper.
"Sorcery? But how could it be? He holds a Kore."
"Something impossibly ancient,"
the abomination said softly.
"Inconceivably beautiful."
One man, a man long dead, looked out from behind the many eyes of Mandate schoolmen. Seswatha, the great adversary of the No-God and founder of the last Gnostic school, their school. In daylight, he was vague, as uncertain as a childhood memory, but at night he possessed them, and the tragedy of his life tyrannized their dreams. Smoky dreams, dreams drawn from the sheath. Akamian watched Anasarimbar Kelmomus, the last high king of Kunayuri, fall beneath the hammer of a baying Srank chieftain. Even though Akamian cried out, he knew with a curious half-awareness belonging to dreams that the greatest king of the Anasarimbar dynasty was already dead, had been dead for more than 2,000 years. And he knew, moreover, that it was not he himself who wailed, but a far greater man, Seswatha. The words boiled to his lips. The Srank chieftain flailed through blistering fire, collapsed into a bundle of rags and ash. More Srank swept the summit of the hill, and more died, struck down by the unearthly light summoned by his song. Beyond, he glimpsed a distant dragon, like a figure of bronze in the setting sun, hanging above warring fields of Srank and men, and he thought, the last Anasarimba king has fallen. Kunayuri is lost. Crying out the name of their king, the tall knights of Trice surged about him, sprinting over the Srank he had burned and falling like madmen upon the masses beyond. With a knight whom he did not know, a Kamian dragged Anasarimba Kelmomas through the frantic cries of his vassals and kinsmen, through the smell of blood, bowel, and charred flesh. In a small clearing, he pulled the king's broken body across his lap. Kelmomas's blue eyes, ordinarily so cold, beseeched him.
Leave me,
the gray-bearded king gasped. No, Akamian replied. If you die, Kelmomas, all is lost. The high king smiled despite his ruined lips.
Do you see the sun? Do you see it flare, Seswatha?
The sun sets, Akamian replied.
Yes, yes, the darkness of the no-god is not all-encompassing. The gods see us yet, dear friend. They are distant, but I can hear them galloping across the skies. I can hear them cry out to me.
You cannot die, Kelmomas. You must not die.
The High King shook his head, stilled him with tender eyes.
They call to me. They say that my end is not the world's end. That burden, they say, is yours. Yours, Seswatha.
No, Akamian whispered. The sun. Can you see the sun, feel it upon your cheek?
Such revelations are hidden in such simple things. I see so clearly what a bitter, stubborn fool I have been. And to you, you most of all, have I been unjust. Can you forgive an old man? Can you forgive a foolish old man?
There's nothing to forgive, Kelmomas. You've lost much, suffered much.
My son, do you think he'll be there, Seswatha? Do you think he'll greet me as his father?
Yes, as his father and as his king.
Did I ever tell you,
Kelmomas said, his voice cracking with futile pride,
that my son once stole into the deepest pits of Golgotharoth?
Yes,
Akamian smiled through his tears. Many times, old friend.
How I miss him, Seswatha. How I yearn to stand at his side once again.
The old king wept for a moment. Then his eyes grew wide.
I see him so clearly. He's taken the sun as his charger, and he rides among us. I see him galloping through the hearts of my people, stirring them to wonder and fury.
Shh! Conserve your strength, my king. The surgeons are coming.
He says such sweet things to give me comfort. He says that one of my seed will return, Seswatha, and Anasarimba will return.
A shudder racked the old man, forcing breath and spittle through his teeth.
At the end of the world.
The bright eyes of Anasarimba Kelmomas II, White Lord of Trice, High King of Kunayuri, went blank. And with them, the evening sun faltered, plunging the bronze-armored glory of the Norsarai into twilight.
Our king!
Akamian cried to the stricken men encircling him.
Our king is dead!
But everything was darkness. No one stood around him, and no king lay propped against his thighs. Only sweaty blankets and a great buzzing absence where the clamor of war had once been. His room. He lay alone in his miserable room. Akamian hugged his arms tight, another dream drawn from the sheath. He drew his hands to his face and wept, a short time for a long-dead Kunayuri king, and longer for other, less certain things. In the distance, he thought he heard howling, a dog or a man. Geshruni was dragged through putrid alleys. He saw pitted wallscapes reel against black sky. His limbs thrashed of their own volition, his fingers clutched at greasy brick. Through bubbling blood, he could smell the river.
My face. What ore?
He tried to cry, but speaking was almost impossible without lips.
I've told you everything!
The sound of boots tramping through watery muck, a giggle from somewhere above him.
If the eye of your enemy offends you, slave, you pluck it out, no?
Please, Ursay, I urge you, Ursay.
Mercy?
The thing laughed.
Mercy is a luxury of the idle fool. The mandate has many eyes, and we have much plucking to do.
Where's my face? Weightlessness, then the crash of cold, drowning water. Akamian awoke in pre-dawn light, his head buzzing with a memory of drink and of more nightmarish dreams, more dreams of the apocalypse. Coughing, he lurched from the straw bed to the room's only window. He drew the lacquered shutter aside, his hands trembling. Cool air, gray light. The palaces and temples of Carathuzel sprawled amid thickets of lesser structures. A dense fog covered the river Sayut, coursing through the alleys and avenues of the lower city like water through trenches. Isolated and as small as a fingernail, the scarlet spires loomed from the ethereal expanse, jutting like dead towers from white desert dunes. Akamian's throat thickened. He blinked tears from his eyes. No fire. No chorus of wails. Everything still. Even the spires affected a breathless, monumental repose. This world, he thought, must not end. He turned from the view to the room's single table and dropped onto the stool, or what passed for one. It looked like something salvaged from a wrecked ship. He wet his quill and, unrolling a small scroll across scattered sheets of parchment, wrote, Fords of Tywenre, same. Burning of the Library of Soglish, different. See my face and not S in mirror. A curious discrepancy. What could it mean? For a moment, he pondered the sour futility of the question. Then he remembered awakening in the heart of night. After a pause, he added, Death and prophecy of Anasarimbor Kelmomas, same. But was it the same? In detail, certainly, but there had been a disturbing immediacy to the dream, enough to wake him. After scratching out, same, he wrote, different, more powerful. As he waited for the ink to dry, he reviewed his previous entries, following them up to the curl of the scroll. A cascade of image and passion accompanied each, transforming mute ink into fragmentary worlds. Bodies tumbling through the knotted waters of a river cataract, a lover grunting blood through clenched teeth, fire wrapped like a wanton dancer about stone towers. He pressed thumb and forefinger against his eyes. Why was he so fixated on this record? Other men, far greater than he, had gone mad trying to decipher the deranged sequence and permutations of Seswatha's dreams. He knew well enough to realize he'd never find an answer. Was it some kind of perverse game, then? One like that his mother used to play when his father returned drunk from the boats, pecking and nettling, demanding reason where none was to be found, flinching each time his father raised his hand, shrieking when he inevitably struck? Why peck and nettle when reliving Seswatha's life was battery enough? Something cold reached through his breastbone and seized his heart. The old tremor rattled his hands, and the scroll rolled shut, wet ink and all. Stop! He clutched his hands together, but the shuddering simply migrated to his arms and shoulders. Stop! The howl of Shrank Horns rifled through his window. He cringed beneath the concussion of dragon's wings. He rocked on the stool, his entire body shaking.
Stop!
For several moments, he struggled to breathe. He heard the distant ping of a coppersmith's hammer, the squabbling of crows on the rooftops.
Is this what you wanted, Seswatha? Is this the way it's supposed to be?
But like so many questions he asked himself, he already knew the answer. Seswatha had survived the No-God and the apocalypse, but he'd known the conflict was not over. The Skilvendi had returned to their pastures. The Srank had scattered to feud over the spoils of a ruined world, but Golgotharoth remained intact. From its black ramparts, the No-God's servants, the Consult, still kept watch, possessed of a patience that dwarfed the perseverance of men. A patience no cycle of epic verses or scriptural admonition could match. Ink might be immortal, but meaning was not. With the passing of every generation, Seswatha had known, the neck of his memory would be further broken. Even the apocalypse would be forgotten. So he passed not from, but into his followers. By reincarnating his harrowing life into their dreams, he had made his legacy a never-ending call to arms. I was meant to suffer, Akamian thought. Forcing himself to confront the day ahead, he oiled his hair and brushed the flecks of muck from the white embroidery trimming his blue tunic. Standing at the window, he calmed his stomach with cheese and stale bread while watching sunlight burn the fog from the black back of the River Sayut. Then he prepared the cants of calling and informed his handlers in Etyursis, the citadel of the School of Mandate, of everything Geshruni had told him the previous night. He was not surprised by their relative disinterest. The secret war between the Scarlet Spires and the Kishorim was, after all, not their war. But the summons to return home did surprise him. When he asked why, they said only that it involved the Thousand Temples, another faction, another war that was not their own. Gathering his few possessions, he thought, one more meaningless mission. How could he not be cynical? In the Three Seas, all the great factions warred with tangible foes for tangible ends, while the Mandate warred against a foe no one could see for an end no one believed in. This made Mandate schoolmen outcasts, not only in the way of sorcerers, but also in the way of fools. Of course, the potentates of the Three Seas, Ketye and Norsarai alike, knew of the Consult and the threat of the Second Apocalypse. How could they not, after centuries of harping Mandate emissaries? But they did not believe. After centuries of skirmishing with the Mandate, the Consult had simply disappeared, vanished. No one knew why or how, though there had been endless speculation. Had they been destroyed by forces unknown? Had they annihilated themselves from within? Or had they simply found a way to elude the eyes of the Mandate? It had been 3 centuries since the Mandate had last encountered the Consult. For 3 centuries, they had waged a war without a foe. Mandate schoolmen traversed the Three Seas hunting for an enemy they could not find and no one believed in. As much as they were envied their possession of the Gnosis, the sorcery of the ancient North, they were a laughingstock, the charlatan in the courts of all the great factions. And yet every night, Seswatha revisited them. Every morning they awoke from the horror and thought, the Consult is among us. Had there ever been a time, Akamian wondered, when he hadn't felt this horror within him, the giddy hollow in the pit of his gut, as though catastrophe hinged upon something he'd forgotten? It came as a breathless whisper, you must do something. But no one in the Mandate knew what it was they should do, and until they did know, all their actions would be as empty as a mummer's play. They would be sent to Carathuzel to seduce high-placed slaves like Geshruni, or to the Thousand Temples to do who knew what. The Thousand Temples. What could the Mandate want with the Thousand Temples? Whatever it was, it warranted abandoning Geshruni, their first real informant within the Scarlet Spires in a generation. The more Akamian pondered this, the more extraordinary it became. Perhaps this mission will be different. The thought of Geshruni made him suddenly anxious. As mercenary as the man was, he had risked far more than his life to give the mandate a great secret. Besides, he was at once intelligent and filled with hate, an ideal informant. It would not do to lose him. After unpacking his ink and parchment, Akamian bent over the table and scratched a quick message. I must leave, but know that your favors have not been forgotten, and that you have found friends who share your purpose. Speak to no one, and we will see you safe. A. Akamian settled his room with the poxed keeper, then began rooting through the streets. He found Cheeky, the orphan he'd employed to run errands, asleep in a nearby alley. The boy was curled in a hemp sack behind a buzzing heap of offal. Aside from the pomegranate-shaped birthmark that marred his face, he looked beautiful, his olive skin dolphin-smooth despite the filth, and his features as fine as any Palatine's daughter. Akamian shuddered to think how the boy made his living outside their paltry transactions. A week previous, Akamian had been accosted by a drunk, the aristocratic paint half smeared from his face, tugging on his crotch, and asking if he'd seen his sweet pomegranate. Akamian roused the sleeping child with the toe of his merchant slipper. The boy fairly leapt to his feet. Do you remember what I taught you, Cheeky? The boy stared at him with the shammed alertness of the just awakened. Yes, Lord, I'm your runner. And what is it that runners do? They deliver messages, Lord, secret messages. Good, Akamian said, holding the folded parchment out to the boy. I need you to deliver this to a man called Geshruni. Remember that, Geshruni. You can't miss him. He's a captain of the Javra, and he frequents the Holy Leper. Do you know where to find the Holy Leper? Yes, Lord. Akamian fetched a silver and solari from his purse and could not help smiling at the boy's awestruck expression. Cheeky snatched the coin from his palms as though from a trap. For some reason, the touch of his small hand moved the sorcerer to melancholy.